Okay, hi. So this would be something completely different, and I apologize because it's not actually in host. So all of this stuff will be in vitro that you'll see today. But it's this neat little research project that kind of fell into my lap this spring. And it was such a nice little puzzle that it was, it's one of these things that kind of reminds you why you fell in love with research to begin with. It was so lovely to solve this puzzle. So I'm going to lead you through how we solved, I think we solved the puzzle. And that should be a very short, relaxing little talk. So I hope you'll enjoy it. So mycoses are fungal infections. And since we're all mathematicians, fungus is one of these. There used to be kingdoms. Now we don't believe in kingdoms anymore. The biologists don't. But when there were kingdoms, fungus was a big kingdom, right? And within that, yeast are unicellular fungi. Molds are fungi that grow with networks of hyphae. So when you hear the word yeast or mold, or mushrooms, big mushrooms, those are all fungi. Mm-hmm. And fungal infections are actually really important. They're an important public health concern. I couldn't get Canadian data, but in the U.S., fungal infections were the seventh leading cause of infectious disease death in the last surveys, but quite important. Usually the species that we hear about for humans are Candida or Aspergillus. And in particular, between 5 and 25% of people who receive heart or lung transplants and 10 to 20% of those in intensive chemotherapy are colonized by some form of fungus. So it's pretty pervasive and very lethal, especially for the immunocompromised, like HIV patients, or cystic fibrosis patients. Fungus, as you can imagine, like to colonize the mucous membranes. And they get into the lungs of CF patients, and it's very toxic. In fact, from the lungs, I just learned this, they get into the bloodstream and can infect the myocardium, so you can actually have fungus growing in the heart tissue. And when that happens, these invasive infections have a 30 to 95% mortality, even with drugs. So they're very, very dangerous. Now that we're all scared of mushrooms, drug resistance, not surprisingly, develops, as with everything else. There are a limited number of antifungal agents because fungus, they are eukaryotes like us, and so finding molecular targets for drug therapy that differ from the homologous molecules in humans is very difficult. So we are much more closely related to fungus than to bacteria or viruses. Right? So antifungals are very difficult to come up with. And likewise, for the same reason, the side effects are even more toxic than those that we've heard about for HIV, for example. And the sad news is that resistance to all the antifungals that are in use has been well documented. And an interesting side note, because I know we have many people that are interested in HIV here, is that some fungi secrete proteases, which helps them in cleaving cell walls, I believe, and when immunocompromised patients such as HIV patients take protease inhibitors, that can actually help against their opportunistic fungal infections. However, the fungi repeatedly develop PI resistance as well. So here's a picture of the fungus in the experimental prep that I'm going to tell you about. This is Aspergillus nigulans in a cartoon. And we start, imagine this is a well plate, so it's a little circle this big, right, covered with some kind of gel that has a rich sugar medium on which the fungus likes to grow. And Aspergillus is filamentous, and that means it grows a net of these hyphae. The hyphae kind of grow, they bifurcate, and typically in the experiment we inoculate, we put a few spores here in the center of the plate, and the colony grows radially, bigger and bigger and bigger. And after it's grown for a while, these conidia spores, their spore heads basically, pop up all over. And each of these can have on the order of 10,000 spores. So population sizes are really big. That's part of the reason why resistance develops, because population sizes are huge. So mutations happen. I think that's all I need to tell you. And here are a couple pictures of Aspergillus. These are courtesy of my collaborators in the Netherlands, and I'll give you their names and show you their pictures at the end. So you can see here, this is where the inoculum was. This circle is where the droplet containing spores was initially put on the plate. And then the colony has grown radially. This is a picture of plate 8 from the top and from the bottom. You can really see the inoculum there. Well, if I take a picture from below. You shouldn't pay attention to this banding for the purposes of this talk. Anyway, the fungi can produce spores in more or greater or fewer spore heads in response to the lighting. So this is like the lights off in the lab, the lights are on in the lab during the day, or it's a cloudy day or something. So the banding isn't really important for us. And this is another picture of Aspergillus. And in this case, the gel contains an antifungal agent. And it doesn't kill the fungus. The fungus just grows more slowly on the antifungal. And what happens here, right about here, a mutation occurred, which conferred resistance to the antifungal. And then this sector of fungus grows faster than the wild type. So this is the mutant, and this is the wild type. And the really nice thing about this prep is that you can see evolution happening. Here is an adaptation. A single beneficial mutant occurred, and it's spreading in the population. So this is a beautiful setup just for addressing elementary population genetics questions. Our most fundamental questions about evolution, I think we can address with setups like these. So I'm also excited, even more than the public health angle, I'm actually very excited in doing some fundamental population genetics in this area. So here's another example. You can see this mutation took over a huge extent of the wild type colony. Oh, I should say take over. Don't get the impression that they grow on top of each other. When the hypha meets the mutant and the wild type, they just stop growing at that point because the sucrose gets deleted or depleted in the gel underneath them. So they don't cross over each other. It's just that the mutant reached this area and colonized it first before the wild type got there.
Why did that happen? Did you eat something or did that happen?
You ate something? The mutation?
Yeah.
It just happens. It just happens, yeah. So we did 50 or 100 plates, and we got 18 new mutations. Yeah. So it just, they're de novo spontaneous mutations. Yeah. There's a lot of, we used a prep in which we knew there was a lot of room to mutate to escape this antifungal. There's a lot of resistant pathways to the antifungal, so we expected that it would happen. This antifungal, I don't know, but I could tell you. There's another example, even better mutation, or worse, depending on your point of view. Here's a little wee one. So this just shows you that sometimes they happen very late in growth. There's a little sector mutant. This one's quite different. The phenotype looks quite different, but it's the same Aspergillus nigellans. In fact, these were all started from clones, so I can't tell you why. But it looks sort of more filamentous, a little feathery, and there's maybe a sector here. And one last one, very flat. Okay, so my goal is to have a predictive model for the emergence of drug resistance. So I'd like to know the fixation probability for these beneficial mutations. Now, I should tell you a bit more about the experimental prep. So we start with an inoculum. A few spores in the center, they grow into a circular colony, and then those spores on the spore heads get washed off. They literally get washed off with water into a bucket, and then we have this solution of water full of spores, and we take a tiny bit of that in a syringe and inoculate a fresh plate, and then the process repeats. So there's this growth, and then sampling into a new plate, growth of the colony, sampling into a new plate. And Jane can tell you that she's probably completely fed up with 10 years of modeling growth and sampling processes. So the modeling of the stochastic growth and stochastic sampling and the fixation probability of the beneficial mutation, that we can do. It's actually mathematically much more challenging and interesting than what I'm going to show you today, but it's kind of turning the crank for techniques that have already been developed. So if we knew how the colonies grew, we can do the sampling and we can predict whether or not this mutation will ultimately take over the whole colony. if we knew, but we need to know the number of mutant and wild type spores in the colony, say at time T when we stop the experiment and wash off the spores. Then we input that, like I said, we can wrap the whole rest of it in branching processes. So we have probability generating functions, we have a prefixed point, we find the extinction probability. I'm not going to talk about that. So we need the area of this mutant colony. So right here, I'd like to know the area of this area, and I'd like to know the area of the wild type, and then I basically am done. Assuming that the spore density is the same in both sides. So I need the boundary. To get the area, I need this line, and I also need the wavefront, this line here. How hard could it be? So here are some wrong approaches, and here I should give credit where credit is due, sorry, because my husband helped me. He's a pure mathematician, and it was like three nights in a row after we put the kids to bed, we scratched our heads and worked on this puzzle to try and figure out what's the right approach to take, and he helped me with several of these wrong approaches, and he also helped me with the right approach. So my first wrong approach was that I'm used to population genetic situations in which there's an initial period of stochasticity. Stochastics are very important when you have this small population at the beginning, and then once things become established, they will grow deterministically. And so my first thought was, the colony started here. Then when it was this big around, say we had a mutation which spontaneously occurred. And then maybe there's a stochastic process in here, and it establishes an angle, an invasion angle. And once that angle is established and the mutant colony is pretty big, it'll just grow like this after we get the angle established. So it'll all be about figuring out what happens stochastically here. And it looks like, for instance, here you can kind of see that there's an angle and it goes out, and maybe that little wedge would be the right model. However, here I was a little bit less encouraged. See how curvy this line is? And here, beautiful curvature, opening up being key. There you can really see that the initial angle widens as time goes on. And in fact, this is a signature shape of these sectors. So these beneficial sectors were described in a Nature paper. They were so excited about this. It was a Nature paper in 1944 that they could see the evolution happening in these fungal mats. And they describe all of these various shapes, but the characteristic of all the shapes is this widening as it grows. So much for that approach. And then I thought about this idea that it matters who gets there first. So this question, they don't cross each other. The question is, which bit, the mutant or the wild type, reaches the point first? So again, you can think at some point when the mutant first appeared, we had a colony like this and a mutant here. And then at later times, I can look at this point and I can say, is it closer to the mutant or is it closer to some wild type from that previous time? And if it's closer to the mutant, it'll be colonized by the mutant first. And I can map out the area of the mutant this way. Of course, I'll have to correct for the fact that the mutant grows faster. That's the deal with the mutant. We care about the beneficial mutations that grow faster. So I'm going to normalize this length and this length by their relative speeds, and that should do it. And I was really excited about that for like 24 hours. And then I realized, what about this point over here? So this guy looks like it might be equidistant. And since the mutant goes faster, it should be colonized by the mutant. And the problem is the mutant can't colonize it along this path, right? The mutant, we know that the angle opens. We know empirically the angle opens. So we have to take into account the whole history of what the mutant has colonized so far to see where the mutant colonizes next. So even though this point is actually closer to the initial mutant, it's going to be colonized by the wild type, and this approach isn't going to work. Okay, so that was wrong. So on to the right approach. And this, I put a question mark here, the right approach question mark in brackets, and then I deleted it because this approach is so beautiful, it just must be right. I don't actually even care if the data support it. It's so lovely and elegant that it's got to be right. So here's my new approach. Let's call the wild type growth rate per tiny unit of time, delta T, W, and M for the mutant. Here's the mycelium, this mat. This is actually the circular colony of the wild type at the moment when the mutation first appears, but we're going to focus in so close that we can neglect the curvature. And in the absence of the mutant, the wild type would have stepped out distance W and delta T. In the absence of the wild type, this is a key insight, I thought, ooh, without the wild type, the mutant would have made a little circle around itself of radius M, right? And therefore, this square is the point at which the wild type and the mutant are going to get to at the same time at the end of delta T. So this square is going to be along the boundary between mutant and wild type. And then we have this beautiful relation with this angle. I call it the invasion angle, so it's the angle at which the mutant invades. You know, it's just given by W and M. And although it would look more natural to do the sine, I'm actually going to talk about the tan of that angle for reasons which will become apparent. So we have the tan of the angle opposite over adjacent. Right. Okay, is that good with everybody? We're all over it. Okay. So some later time, let me back up. Now I'm going to look over here. Time has been going on for a while, and now we have the mutant colony and the wild type colony meeting at some angle that I don't know. So here they are meeting each other, wild type mycelium, mutant mycelium. I call the boundary mutant this guy that's on the very edge of the mutant mycelium, right along the boundary between the two. And you do the same argument. In the absence of the mutant, the wild type would have marched forward like this. This boundary mutant would make a circle around himself, and we get exactly the same triangle. So we get the same phi. So irrespective of the angle that this is on, you can see that I could rotate this whole thing, and phi would be completely unchanged. Right, so the invasion angle is going to be relative to the tangent to the wavefront of the wild type. And then this is the really beautiful part. So sometime even later in time, we've got this boundary. We don't really know what the boundary equation is. All we know is this angle. But look at this in spherical coordinates, and it just falls out for you. So if we knew that when we were at angle theta, the boundary was at radius r, then in theta plus d theta, we go out by dr. And this angle is the angle that has to be phi, which is only defined by W and M. And this little piece of that triangle is R d theta. You with me? Yeah. And so you get tan phi is dr over R d theta. Is this not lovely? This is so lovely. Especially after three evenings of how can we solve this problem? So from the triangle, we've got this, which we can rearrange like this, and now we have dr d theta, tan phi is a constant times r. And I'm even more excited about this because I'm teaching differential equations in the fall, and like the first week I can say, this summer I used something that you guys can solve, and I can give them this, and they can solve it in their first week of the GE's course. So we get this, r of theta is some initial radius when the mutation first occurs, e to the tan phi theta, and there's tan phi. And now when I first looked at this, I was really confused about the m in the denominator. Because when m is very large, that means the mutant's very strong. It goes really fast. And then tan phi would be very small. Phi would be very small. Well, actually, tan phi would be very small. That's all we care about. And so this exponential increase is smaller, and that seems counterintuitive to me. But you have to think that it's the exponential increase in the radius as we increase the angle. So you've got your angle going. And the radius of the boundary, if it increased really fast, you'd have a very narrow sector, right? And if it increased very slowly, you could take over almost the whole colony. Yeah? So it's fine. So then I wrote a little program. This took like the next 3 days. And in the program, you know, I click on the center of the colony, and I click on the edge, and I click on the edge and the beginning of the mutant sector. And from those measurements, I get M and W, right? And then I adjust an opening angle to fit the boundary with my equation. Here's an example. There we go. So the blue guy is the opening angle, that invasion angle, and you can see I've got a prediction for the boundary. And I pull this guy around. until the boundary matches. And so this gives me a fitted value of phi, the invasion angle, and then I can compare that to the predicted value of phi given M and W. Okay. And so then I did that for the 18 beneficial sectors that my collaborators could send me pictures of. And I apologize that, well, just like you saw last time, once I got this image into my own home-baked program and then spit back out again, I couldn't make them exactly line up. So I'm sorry that the lines don't just appear. The image is going to move every time. So there's that funny sector. Maybe okay. This one is a really nice fit, I think. Isn't it lovely? And this guy, look at that. It's really nice, huh? So I think we can fit all these different, quite different shapes, right? These ones all have fairly different shapes, and we're getting really good fits. I think they're very good for messy biology, except maybe this guy. So here, I'm not sure. But the opening angle here would have to be really, really wide, and that's just not predicted by the ratio of the lengths. I'm wondering if I should have drawn the purple line here, then it looks like the wild type is growing a little bit more slowly in this direction. You know, maybe this gel, the sugar wasn't uniform, and it's growing more slowly in this direction, and then it's actually the wild, or the mutant's actually better than it looks. And here are the final results. So we have, this is the predicted invasion angle from the ratio of M and W, and this is the fitted invasion angle. And you can see lots of the cases that I'm very excited about are right on the line of identity, which is the dotted line. And there are a few outliers, and these are just, like this last one, they're weird-looking, slightly weird-looking sectors that the model didn't fit well. And these are my collaborators. Good. So they're from the Laboratory of Genetics at Wageningen University, and I did a web search. I was like, Wageningen University, I should say where that is. And then I do this whole, their web page, why don't they say what city they're in? And it turns out they're in Wageningen. That's why they don't say. So that's in the city of Wageningen in the Netherlands. And Dana actually has worked at the University of Ottawa with Reese Cass, and she's just doing a summer project on this stuff with Arjun de Visser, who's the PI at Wageningen. And my funding, and that's about it. Yeah. Well, if it all comes down to growth rate, I don't think we could. But I think there are other mutants. Like we could maybe, in that feathery one, it's not clear that it's really growing that much faster, but there is a sector. Like maybe it has a higher spore density. There are other ways to have a beneficial mutation, right? Or you could grow on, they could actually take over each other's territory a little bit if they could grow on medium with less sugar, right? So I stop here, but the mutant can actually get in. So there are a bunch of different mechanisms of beneficial mutation, and yeah, I'd love to look into that. Catherine. I would say our experimental, I mean, we have the experiments, right? That's better than any agent-based model could ever be. And then we're trying to build our global model from the experiments.
Yeah, if you build an agent-based model of the experimental system, you can get it working from first principles and then extract. So, I mean, I don't mind.
Yeah. No, I've done a lot of agent-based modeling as well. I think in this case, I would only go to agent-based modeling. I find it harder, right, to extract the key principles. If you can get the key principles in one exponential equation, then I think you don't need it, right? I would go that way if I really couldn't understand what's going on. That would be my next step. Yeah, we're assuming right now, and it's really important, it's not the cells so much, but those spore heads that produce 10,000 spores apiece. So we're assuming that the density of spore heads is the same, but this is another mechanism. So when I spoke about they could have different mechanisms of beneficial mutation, you could increase your spore head density, for example, and that would be another completely different type of mutation. Well, mechanistically, I don't know, but it's a growth rate advantage. Because these ones that we see are the ones where they have a growth rate advantage. That's sort of why we can see them. It's the speed of colonizing, yeah, the 2D system. Mm-hmm.